You know, if you really want to get a handle on transnational terror and crime, you often find yourself looking past the big headlines, past the political statements. You end up focusing on something much more, well, mundane. The logistics. Where are they getting the safe houses, the fake IDs, the cars? Let's rewind a bit back to Buenos Aires in the 1990s. It was a period marked by horrific targeted violence. First, the 1992 bombing of the Israeli embassy. And then, just 2 years later, the 1994 attack on the AMIA Jewish Community Center. That one left 85 people dead. I mean, between the two, that's 114 lives lost, hundreds more injured. And getting justice, well, for decades, that was incredibly complicated. But fast forward to earlier this year, April 2024, we saw a huge development from Argentina's Federal Criminal Cassation Court, a landmark ruling, really. They stated very clearly, Iran gave the orders for the AMIA attack and Hezbollah carried it out. And crucially, they labeled the AMIA bombing a crime against humanity. Then, just this past June, another step. A judge gave the green light for trials in absentia for the suspects, people who have basically dodged accountability since the 90s. Okay, so let's unpack this a little. The ruling tells us who was behind it, strategically and operationally. But for intelligence folks, for security agencies, the big question isn't just who, it's how. How did this network manage the sheer logistics to pull off something that big so far from their home base? So our mission today is to dig into why the tri-border area, you know, that spot where Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay all meet, why it was, and frankly still is, such a perfect place for these networks to operate, to hide, and to keep their supply lines running.
Right. When we talk about the TBA, the tri-border area, you have to picture how the geography kind of erases the borders on the ground. Think of three big cities basically functioning as one giant zone. You've got Ciudad del Este in Paraguay, that's a massive center for electronics, and importantly, cash flowing pretty freely. Then there's Foz do Iguaçu over in Brazil, huge for tourism, but also heavy-duty logistics, freight, and Puerto Iguaçu in Argentina, sort of the gateway for international visitors, lots of hotels. And linking them all, two major bridges, plus this incredibly busy river system, constant movement.
It sounds like this intense economic zone. But it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, okay, so one gang runs the whole show there. But the sources we've looked at, they really push back on that idea. They suggest it's less like a monopoly
Exactly.
and more like a marketplace, a really busy, sophisticated logistics market.
That's a perfect way to put it. A logistics supermarket, almost. The infrastructure itself, getting documents, finding storage, moving quickly across those three borders, it's all service-based. It genuinely doesn't care who the customer is. Need fake papers. Encrypted comms, lookouts, need to stage vehicles quickly or get a favor at customs. The services are completely agnostic.
Yeah.
So if you were, say, financing those attacks back in the 90s, you weren't trying to control the TBA. No way. You were just renting specific things you needed, like maybe setting up some shell companies to wash money into local currency, or using local safe houses to plan surveillance, getting clean cars with forged papers that wouldn't raise flags crossing between Paraguay and Brazil. You basically bought anonymity and speed.
And what's really striking is that this isn't just history. You look at what major Brazilian crime groups like the PCC, Primeiro Comando da Capital, and the Comando Vermelho, the CV, are doing right now,
Absolutely.
and it shows how valuable that same setup still is.
For sure. The PCC, I mean, they're one of the most powerful TCOs, transnational organized crime groups, in South America. And just recently, both in 2024 and again in 2025, there were security alerts in Paraguay's Alto Paraná area, which includes Ciudad del Este. Alerts about potential mega robberies being planned by the PCC. These are complex, high-stakes operations, far from their usual bases. Why there?
Because the TBA lets them tap into that same marketplace.
Exactly, that same set of available capabilities that anyone else can use.
And the CV's active too, right? Didn't they catch an operative in Capitán Bedú just this June?
Yep, that's right.
So if these big organized crime groups can use the TBA to plan huge heists and move drugs, it just highlights how easily a terror network could, and likely still does, use it for maybe smaller but just as crucial logistical tasks.
And underpinning all of this activity, both legal trade and the illegal stuff, is that massive Paraguay-Paraná waterway. That river system is, on one hand, an economic lifeline, vital for legal commerce, but it's also this huge temptation, a massive vulnerability. For traffickers, it's like a superhighway. You see cocaine coming from the Andes, moving down the river system, right through the TBA, and then heading out to Atlantic ports to be shipped worldwide. The sheer volume of traffic boats, barges, cargo containers, it creates this constant dense fog that makes it easier for illicit actors to hide their movements.
Okay, that link, high-level terror logistics, TCO drug running, all using the same rented infrastructure. That's key.
Sure.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If the governments know this is the spot, if they understand the geography, why is it still so incredibly hard for Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay to really clamp down effectively? What are the big operational hurdles giving the advantage to the networks?
Well, we generally see three major persistent headwinds operationally, and they really give the criminal networks the edge, mostly in terms of time. The first big one is what you could call jurisdictional seams. Just think about it logically. You've got three independent countries operating side by side. That means three totally different legal systems, three separate criminal codes, different rules for what counts as evidence, how you can collect it, and three distinct, often very slow, processes for extradition. So if I'm running a network, I'm going to deliberately split my operations across those seams. Maybe I store my cash in Paraguay, base my people temporarily in Brazil, and arrange for my illicit goods in Argentina.
Right. So how does that actually shield the criminal in practice?
It buys time. It's all about the clock. Let's say Paraguayan police raid a stash house. Okay, fine. But maybe the key assets, the people, or the next batch of goods, are already across the bridge in Brazil. By the time Paraguay makes the formal request to Brazil, gets the paperwork approved, navigates the legal channels for cooperation, maybe Brazil needs more evidence according to their standards. The trail goes cold, the evidence is moved, the people scatter. Each border, instead of being a wall against crime, becomes a kind of temporary shield, buying the network crucial hours or days to adapt and just move somewhere else. And that time advantage you mentioned, that gets amplified by the second major issue, operational throughput. Just the sheer volume of legitimate people and goods moving through the area? Oh, absolutely. It's the classic needle in a haystack problem, but scaled up massively. Take the Friendship Bridge, the Ponte da Amizade, linking Brazil and Paraguay. At peak times, estimates suggest something like 93,000 pedestrians cross that bridge every single day. That's more people than live in a lot of towns, just flowing back and forth daily across one bridge. Trying to implement really thorough screening or deep inspections on that kind of scale, it's basically impossible without bringing the entire legitimate economy to a grinding halt.
So the organized criminals, the terror financiers, they just blend in, melt into the background noise of everyday business.
Exactly. They hide in plain sight. They count on the fact that law enforcement has to focus their limited resources on the most obviously suspicious cases, which leaves this vast, dense, gray area of routine commerce, where they can operate with much less scrutiny. And like we talked about, trying to monitor the river traffic across hundreds of miles of waterway, that's an even bigger challenge. Okay, so jurisdictional seams, overwhelming traffic flow. Now the third challenge, the one that maybe fundamentally makes it cheaper, easier for these networks to operate, corruption. That sort of political and bureaucratic weakness. Yeah, corruption acts like a huge subsidy for the entire criminal ecosystem in a place like the TBA. If it's widespread, it fundamentally changes the calculation for criminals. It turns what should be a major operational hurdle getting caught into just another business expense you can budget for. Why go to all the trouble of complex smuggling if you can just bribe a key customs official to, you know, look the other way for a couple of hours? When high-level officials, whether in customs, procurement, even security forces, are compromised, the price of a critical favor, maybe a tip-off about a raid, leaked intel, or just ensuring a slow response drops dramatically. It becomes affordable.
And we have some pretty stark examples of this from the sources, don't we? I mean, the U.S. imposing sanctions on really high-profile figures in Paraguay.
That sent shockwaves, yeah. It was a very strong signal about the depth of the problem. In 2023, the U.S. Treasury, through OFAC, sanctioned several very senior Paraguayan officials. We're talking about a former president and the current vice president at the time. The allegations involved corruption and links to illicit networks. That's not just low-level graft. That suggests institutional compromise right at the top. And then you start again in 2024. OFAC went after a major Paraguayan tobacco company, Tabesa. The sanctions cited illicit tobacco smuggling, but also explicitly linked it back to those same networks of corruption. It wasn't just about cigarettes. It was about showing how systemic governance weaknesses are actively leveraged by global criminal enterprises. Okay, the picture is networks exploiting legal seams, hiding in the sheer volume of commerce, and effectively buying protection through corruption. These are deep structural challenges. They seem really persistent.
But connecting this back, we are seeing some signs, right? That the governments involved are trying to shift gears, trying to move beyond just reacting case by case and build something more institutional, more durable.
That shift is absolutely crucial. There seems to be a growing realization that just doing periodic raids or temporary crackdowns isn't enough. You need permanent cooperative structures. Look at the Comando Tripartito. That's the joint command structure between Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay. It was actually set up way back in 1996 after the AMIA bombing, but honestly, it kind of floundered for years.
Yeah.
But in May 2025, they announced a significant update to that agreement. The goal was specifically to improve how they share intelligence in real time and make joint operations the standard way of doing business, not just a special event.
And then, hot on the heels of that, the announcement this past July about a new dedicated intelligence base. That feels like a concrete step.
Yeah, that's potentially very significant. They announced this new tripartite intelligence base will be physically located in Puerto Iguazu, Argentina. And its specific mission is to centralize intelligence gathering focused on organized crime and terrorism in the TBA. But what makes this potentially different, what gives it teeth, is the technical backing. The FBI is providing technical support for setting up and running this base. That implies, hopefully, a durable technical infrastructure, standardized operating procedures, and maybe crucially, access to the kind of high-level analytical expertise you need to really understand and track these complex transnational networks. It aims to move cooperation beyond just political agreements, which can change with elections, and embed it in a more persistent technical framework that's harder to dismantle.
So tying this all together for you, the listener, what's the big takeaway here? Our deep dive really sketches out a kind of blueprint, doesn't it? You have strategic attacks like AMIA conceived elsewhere, but their execution relies entirely on these local networks. Networks that are experts at exploiting the gaps, the misalignments between different countries' laws and enforcement. They thrive where governance is maybe a bit weak and commerce moves incredibly fast.
Exactly. And the crucial point, the real lesson here, is that the only response that stands a chance of being truly effective in the long run, the kind that might actually dismantle the TBA as this convenient safe haven, has to be deep, institutionalized, cross-border cooperation, the kind that can outlast political shifts and personal relationships. Understanding this helps you see that major global crime or terrorism isn't always about super sophisticated spycraft. A lot of it relies on the ability to just rent mundane local services and exploit those seams in governance that are effectively up for sale. And maybe here's a final thought to chew on as we wrap up. We see the governments building these new intelligence centers, signing these updated agreements, which is progress, no doubt. But think about the nature of these illicit networks, especially those linked to terrorism or deep-rooted organized crime. They often rely heavily on things like kinship ties, family connections, deep roots in the local community. They operate through small storefronts, seemingly legitimate businesses that are woven into the very fabric of the local economy. So the question becomes, how does that kind of organic social resilience, the kind built on relationships and community integration, make these illicit networks inherently more adaptable, perhaps more difficult to truly root out, than the more formal bureaucratic state structures trying to fight them? That underlying tension, that's something that will likely continue to shape the struggle in the tri-border area for a long time to come.